Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a brilliant and hard-hitting speech by Chris Hedges. The system cannot be fixed, and only a revolution of a sort can save us the people, says Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. August 2016, and here we are, late in an election campaign that is leaving a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Near as I can see, almost nobody wants Hillary Clinton to be president, and few want Donald Trump. The establishment-controlled, corporate-owned news media are not even going to mention Green Party candidate Jill Stein. My very rough estimate is that Stein has more enthusiastic supporters than Hillary Clinton does. If the United States were actually a democracy, Stein would have some shot at winning. Of course, if we actually were a democracy, the Democratic Party would have nominated Bernie Sanders. Instead, the Democrats offer us the corporate-sponsored child of Wall Street, Hillary R. Clinton, Mitt Romney in lipstick and a necklace. We'll get to transgender bathrooms later. Chris Hedges has a few caustic things to say about both the conservative Republican candidate, that is, Hillary Clinton, and her former opponent, the liberal Democrat Bernie Sanders. About Mr. Trump, he says very little, except this. This is what you get when an oligarchy oppresses, squeezes, and stresses the common people to the very limit, and beyond. He saw the same thing happen in Yugoslavia. At least Donald Trump is easier to pronounce than Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic. These days, we need the radical imagination and radical voices more than ever. We need to get away from all the superficial conflicts, the trivia, the meaningless sensationalism that the establishment wants to distract you with. The people who own and run our country do not want you to think seriously about our $1 trillion annual military spending. They do not want you to think about our policy of eternal, unending war. Or about climate change, unaffordable health care, massive unemployment, and a government of, by, and for the fat cats that pay for it. No, the powers that be, through the mass media that they own, would like you to focus instead on Hillary's emails, the Olympics, the Kardashians, and which bathroom transvestites should use. We need radical voices and radical visions addressing the roots of our serious overlapping crises. That's what radical means, from the Latin for root. One of today's radical voices belongs to journalist and essayist Chris Hedges. He spoke in Seattle in April 2016 and was captured on video by Ed Mays of Pirate TV. I labored mightily, cleaning up the sound for radio broadcast, snipping out many long pauses, and cranking up the volume when Hedges' voice trails off. Yes, sound editing is dirty, thankless, wrist-breaking labor, but somebody's got to do it. It's no worse than picking tomatoes in Immokalee, Florida. But enough maudlin self-pity. Hedges titled his talk, The Algebra of Revolution, and we shall hear it, God willing, this week and next. Here is part one.
Obviously, tonight I'm going to look at the political morass that we have fallen into and examine the insurgent candidates, Trump and Sanders, what that means. For the last 10 years, I've been not just writing about, but reporting on the malaise of American society. 2 years with the Christian right in megachurches across the country, an examination of the American liberal establishment and what has happened to it in Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle. It's how you get a reality star like Trump as a viable presidential candidate. Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt with the great Joe Sacco. Again, we spent 2 years on that book, traveling to the poorest pockets of the United States to look at the nature of unfettered, unregulated capitalism, what it does in these sacrifice zones, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, second poorest county in the United States, where the average male has a life expectancy of 48, that is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti, where at any one time 80% of the residents have neither electricity or running water. This is America. Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in America, and not surprisingly, the year we were there, per capita the most dangerous city in America in terms of homicides. Coal fields of southern West Virginia, produce fields in Immokalee, Florida. The point of that book being that it's incumbent upon all of us to look at these sacrifice zones, these places that were sacrificed first by corporate power, corporate interests, because we've all become a sacrifice zone. And of course, my last book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, where I write that the most pressing existential crisis of our time is to grasp what lies before us, in particular the effects of climate change, and yet resist anyway. That rebellion has a moral imperative. I was arrested last week in front of the Capitol for Democracy Spring. And so that 10-year period when I came back from overseas, where I had covered disintegrating societies, whether in the former Yugoslavia, I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. And because I had reported on that process day by day, I brought that body of experience back into the United States and went out into my own country, in many ways a foreign country to me after a 20-year absence. And what has now appeared before us are many of the symptoms, visible symptoms of a society in deep, and one could even argue perhaps terminal, decay. And as all of you who, like me, read climate change reports, you know we have no time left. In Death of the Liberal Class, I talk a lot about that process by which our radical movements opened up the space in American democracy. Howard Zinn, of course, makes this point in The People's History of the United States. One of the advantages of teaching in a post-literate society is that when I submit my reading list to the prison authorities, they have no idea what are in these books. So I write up a very boring survey of American history and our three branches of government, and it gets approved, and then I give all of my students The People's History of the United States. I taught a class was a year ago spring, called Conquest. And I used Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins on the Haitian Revolution. And I'd given my students the syllabus, and there was a Wednesday that I wasn't there. I was in Montana. And I got a phone call in the hotel room, and they said, this is the Special Investigations Division of the Department of Corrections of the state of New Jersey, and do you know that your students just led a sit-down strike in our prison? And we think you're behind it. And so they revoked my credentials until I went in for a two-hour interrogation. And I didn't know about the sit-down strike, but in a way I was behind it, of course, because they had read those books and understood that, as Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing without demand. And it was very moving. It was moving, and kind of got to the theme of the last book, because they all knew what was going to happen to them. You're not getting out of a prison. And their cells were searched, and they were interrogated, and they did find the leaders, the two leaders, who were immediately shipped to another prison and put in solitary confinement. But we've reached a moment in American history where those mechanisms within a capitalist democracy that had once been able to protect our basic rights and address our basic grievances have been taken from us. We've undergone, as John Ralston Saul says, a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And in Death of the Liberal Class, I go back to World War I. The great writer Dwight MacDonald, a writer I like very much, says that World War I was the rock on which radical movements were broken. And they were broken by Woodrow Wilson, one of the darkest presidents in American history. Aside from being a racist, he created the system, first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, the Creel Commission, pioneered the understanding of crowd psychology under Le Bon, Trotter, Sigmund Freud, and others. Passed the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act. And when you go back and read the radicals of that period, Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, they decry how effective that system of mass propaganda was, which appealed, of course, to how people feel. That people were not moved by facts or reason, but by that manipulation of emotion, and how effective it was in turning even socialists and the intellectual class behind the war effort. And they write with some despair. And we entered, after World War I, a period MacDonald describes as unique in modern history. And that is a culture gripped by what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. He said none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, anticipated the psychosis of permanent war, where the day World War I is over, the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. And after the war, they shut down Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal with the fourth highest circulation in the country. They shut down the masses. They deport Emma Goldman and Berkman and other radicals in the Palmer raids. Eugene V. Debs, at this point, is already in prison and will sit in prison until, I think it's 1922. And that was the time in which these movements that had opened up our closed system, and our system was designed to be closed. You read the Federalist Papers, and there is a deep and abiding fear of direct or popular democracy, and all sorts of mechanisms put into place to prevent that possibility, including the Electoral College. That's how Al Gore gets 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush, and George W. Bush is appointed president by judicial fiat by the Supreme Court. Senators were originally appointed, and of course, at the beginning, women African Americans, Native Americans, white men without property were all denied the vote. And so you had that struggle, long and bloody struggle, at the end of the 19th century. We had the bloodiest labor wars of any industrialized nation. Hundreds of American workers were murdered. Tens of thousands were blacklisted by vigilante groups, the Gun Thugs, the Pinkertons, the Baldwin Felts. And from the end of World War I, that past century in American history, there has been, in the name first of the war against communism, a mechanism by which the populist and radical movements that organized to open up the space, the abolitionists, the suffragists, the labor movement, were destroyed. And then, of course, after, in particular, World War II, with the McCarthy hearings, Ellen Schrecker has written two very good books on this. One on the academy, No Ivory Tower, about the purging of the universities, not just the universities, but the high schools, so that the FBI would go into high schools with a list of 4, 5, 6, 7 teachers who were communist or soft on communism, or without, of course, any evidence, and they would immediately be fired and blacklisted. And the more high-profile attacks against Pete Seeger or Hollywood are known. But Schrecker points out that this was just pervasive throughout the society. The only mechanism that we have as citizens to protect our rights and defend our interests has never come through formal political parties, but through movements and organizations that never achieved positions of power, but held fast to moral imperatives. One can see it in the civil rights movement under King, where certainly until he was assassinated in April of 1968, he was one of the most powerful political forces in the country, because when he went to Memphis or Selma, 50,000 people went with him. And that mechanism by which we forced power to respond came from movements. And it was a liberal establishment that was able to ameliorate the system in such a way to mitigate the anger and the frustration. And the classic example of that is Roosevelt's New Deal, where Roosevelt writes that if his fellow oligarchs do not begin to respond to the widespread suffering, they will get revolution. That's Roosevelt. Those are Roosevelt's words. And so in essence, he tells his fellow oligarchs that it's better to give up some of your money now, or you may lose all of it. And that is how we get government created 12 million jobs, public works, Social Security. And Roosevelt, looking back, says that his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And we've forgotten that history, in large part because it's not taught. The historical amnesia which has gripped the country is by design. And with the fusion of corporate and military power after World War II, because, of course, we did not demobilize the arms industry, as we did after World War I, but united it with the corporatists, who used massive amounts of federal spending to keep us, in essence, on a war footing, but also worked with the corporatists to destroy any political figure or any movement that challenged that corporate military cabal that is, I think, as Seymour Melman, the economist at Columbia, argued, disemboweled, destroyed the economy. Henry Wallace would be a good example, Roosevelt's former vice president, who ran in 48, and until McGovern was probably the last figure to really rise up against the military establishment. And this, of course, something that Sanders has not done, because challenging that establishment is political suicide. which he is fully aware of. And yet at the same time, we are never going to have a society that is able to roll back these programs of austerity. We just saw a week ago a million more people erased from the welfare, from the food stamp program. It's just this slow descent. And so the radical movements were broken. In the name of anti-communism, the liberal establishments were destroyed. That's how you get a figure like Bill Clinton, both the Clintons, who create this fictional form of liberalism, and Obama is not exempt from this, where you speak in the old language of liberalism, but you betray the very constituency that you claim to represent. And I think that's what's happened in both parties. So the Republican Party has looked at nativists and right-wing Christians and anti-abortion activists and people in the gun culture as their useful idiots, and the Democrats have looked at people of color, the poor, unions, the traditional educated elite as their useful idiots. They have both essentially turned politics into anti-politics, and by that I mean the culture wars are not about politics. And so that on all of the major structural issues, whether it is the expansion of imperial power beyond our ability to sustain it, now the longest wars in U.S. history, and I speak as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East, what do we have to show for it? Aside from the wholesale destruction of countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, the creation of failed states like Libya or ISIS, it makes no sense. But of course, there are powerful corporate interests for whom war is a great business. A Tomahawk cruise missile costs $1.1 million, and when they invaded Libya over a span of days, they dropped 500 of them. That's $500 million. The whole expansion of NATO, this makes no sense in terms of national security. We had promised Gorbachev, Reagan had promised Gorbachev with the fall of the Berlin Wall that NATO would not be expanded beyond Germany. But it's expanded because Poland and Czechoslovakia, and these are arms markets. And I think that we are seeing foreign policy virtually hijacked by corporate forces in contravention of what makes any sense, not only in terms of foreign policy, but in terms of military policy. But that has just been writ large now throughout the entire culture, the whole primacy of profit. And no society that I know of in the last few thousand years of human civilization has ever embraced the notion that the dictates of the market should determine the construction of a society itself. It is a species of utopianism. That's what neoliberalism is. It's not a rational idea. It's an ideology which, as Marx understood, serves the interests of that tiny corporate elite that profits from it. But all of the ideas that were sold to us about neoliberalism as bolstering the middle class and providing jobs and even protecting democracy, because of course neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy, it destroys democracy, have now been proven false across the political spectrum. And you're watching this rage, legitimate rage, rise up throughout American society. And much of that rage is being expressed especially by a white underclass, in the traditional forms of fascism. I was in Montgomery, Alabama, with the great civil rights attorney, Brian Stevenson, who spent his life fighting on behalf of prisoners on death row, not surprisingly, most of whom are poor and black. And we were walking through Montgomery, and Brian was pointing out all the new Confederate memorials that had been put up throughout the city, all within the last 10 years, including a massive Confederate flag that flies now on the outskirts of the city. Half of Montgomery is black. It is where Dr. Martin Luther King began his ministry. It is where Rosa Parks refused to give her seat up on the bus. And before I had gotten there, a few weeks before, the Sons of the Confederacy had held a reenactment of Jefferson Davis's inaugural on the steps of the state capitol because Montgomery was the original Southern White House, Southern seat. And I said to Brian, this is exactly what I saw in Yugoslavia. That when people are pushed to such a moment of despair and hopelessness, they retreat into a mythical vision of the past, a form of magical thinking. The idea that the economic destruction of America, much of it we must lay at the feet of Bill Clinton or NAFTA, and of course they're going to vote on this new trade agreement, the TPP, in the lame duck session after the elections. The idea that persecuting Muslims or undocumented workers or homosexuals is somehow going to make America great again. But it shows the way people have unplugged themselves from the difficulties before them, the inability to grasp what's been done to them.
Chris Hedges with part one of The Algebra of Revolution. Part two next week. Thanks again to Pirate TV Seattle for the original recording, which I have polished up for radio. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find our free archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust advising illegitimi non carborundum, the lesser of two evils is still evil, and please come back again next week. Ciao.